What we're going to do in this course is really to quantize gravity, but because it's quite a complicated system, we're going to focus on something a bit simpler, which is already looking at 3D Euclidean gravity and with a cosmological constant. And so, of course, I will explain why things really simplified in this context and what are the complications when we go to 4D case with a Lorentzian signature and maybe even a cosmological constant. Okay, but from this, starting from this system, we can really apply the loop quantum gravity method, and which is really, in fact, just applying Dirac quantization program to this system and get what we call loop quantum gravity. Okay, so we're going to do really that step by step. But for today, before going to gravity, we're just going to focus on the canonical formulation of constraint system and this notion of gauge transformation. Okay, and so here to start with, I have two questions to ask you. Why are we interested in constraint systems? Okay, I'm telling you that our system of interest is gravity. Why are we going to spend some time talking about constraint system in general? And then the other question is, can we relate these constraints to the symmetries and in particular to gauge symmetries? Okay, so these are the two questions we're going to focus on for today. And so to start with the first one, so question one. Okay, so first, it's very usual in physics to describe a system with constraints. For example, just a pendulum, you could choose to describe your pendulum instead of using x and y variable, and then constrain them to be that just x squared plus l squared is equal to l squared, okay, the length of your pendulum. So it's something quite usual. And so now let's look at the, so we're going to be interested about gravity. So what is our main field? As we said yesterday, what we want to quantize is the gravitational field or the metric. Okay. So this is our object of interest, g mu nu, and how many independent components do we have here? So if we are in 4D, this is a symmetric tensor. So we get 4 times 5 divided by 2. So we get 10 independent component, whereas how many kind of physical degrees of freedom are we expecting here in this context? Yeah, 2. Okay, so here we have like 10 component, and the idea is we want to go to 2. So this is in 4D. If we do the same thing in 3D, so instead of 10 here, we're going to get 3 times 4 divided by 2, so it's 6. And how many in 3D are we expecting? It's going to be one reason why 3D gravity is so simple.
Zero.
Yeah, zero, because it's a topological theory. So we're going to come back on that. So there is no local degrees of freedom. Okay, the only degrees of freedom are going to be topological degrees of freedom. Okay, so you see that indeed, and even as I mentioned yesterday, to perform like the Dirac program on gravity, if you stay with the metric variables, then usually, so this will give at the classical level, the canonical formulation of gravity in terms of metric is what we call the ADM formalism. And again, then here you're going to be a system, you're going to have an Hamiltonian written in terms of constraint, but these constraints are non-polynomial in your metric variable, so we don't really know how to quantize. So as I mentioned yesterday, how we went around this was thanks to Ashteka, we introduced this new variable. So here we're not going to work, in our case, we're not going to work with a metric variable, but we're going to work with, well, in 3D, it's going to be triad and connection, but in particular the triad. So if now we have a triad field, we even have more components, okay, here. So these are going to be the internal degrees of freedom, which is can take 3 values, 1, 2, 3, okay, for the SU2 group. And mu is, again, the space-time variable, so space-time indices. So you, again, have 3, okay? So 3 times 3 is equal to 9. And again, we want to go to 0. So you can expect that going to from the metric formulation to the triad formulation, and then we will have a connection. So the Palatini formalism, as I was mentioning yesterday, we're going to add even have more constraint in our system, okay? But so this was just to, and so to, yeah, make sure that, yeah, we are really interested in constraint system in general, and everything we're going to see, in fact, are quite general and can be applied to any constraint system. And at some point, we focus on gravity, but it's really, the beginning is going to be general. So what is a constraint? A constraint, we're going to work in the Hamiltonian formulation, a canonical formulation. So we talk about a constraint on our phase space. So it's going to be a function of Q and P, all the Q and P of our system, that is equal to zero. This is our constraint, the way we're going to write constraint. And what we want is that this hold at every instant of time in the evolution of our, of the system. Of time. And so what does it mean? It means that a constraint is a conserved quantity. Okay, so it's one that is vanishing, but it's a, still a conserved quantity. And now the question is, we want to relate. So if we go to the second question was to relate constraint to symmetries or gauge symmetry in particular. So now the question become more conserved quantity. What is the relation between conserved quantity and symmetries? Okay, so this is the second question. And this is something you should be really familiar in the Lagrangian formalism, where you know Noether theorem. So here we have now conserved quantities that we want to relate to symmetries. Okay, and right now it's symmetries in general, and we're going to see that we need to make the distinction if we want to talk about gauge symmetries. So again, in Lagrangian formalism, what you know is that symmetry imply conserved quantity. Okay, this is this kind. This is from Noether theorem, and now we're going to see what does it mean more in the Hamiltonian formalism. But before going to the Hamiltonian formalism, okay, the formulation, Hamiltonian formulation, I want to take just the time to make the distinction between two kinds of symmetries that are going to be important. So here we can have what we call symmetries that are global, okay, and this is the one you're most familiar with, and the gauge symmetry. And what is a gauge symmetry in terms just of here is that it's local, so it has two kind of characteristics. It's a local and non-trivial transformation. Of the field, or it can also, so let's just say the fields right now, it can also, as we have seen yesterday in the tutorial yesterday, it can also transform the space-time coordinates, but just keep that for the moment. This is not too important. What I just want to emphasize is these two characteristics and kind of give you a bit what this means here. And so by local, what I mean is that it does, the gauge transformation do not affect any boundary value. Okay. Okay, I'm going to come back on that. On the and non-trivial here, it means that it acts non-trivially on the extrema of the of your action. On the extrema. And so what does it mean here? This means that here, extrema now are not really proper extrema, but they're going to feature some gate, what we call gauge direction, along which the action is going to be constant. Okay, so you have this kind of new feature. And the fact that here it do not affect any boundary value, this means that now if you start from a given boundary value or if you want an initial condition, then the problem will not have just a unique solution in the presence of this kind of gauge transformation. Okay, so this really means that now if you start from this is your initial condition, you expect instead of just a unique evolution, now you expect that you can have a different kind of evolution, and what we're going to say is that these two are physically equivalent, okay, gauge equivalent. Okay, so this is something that is going to be really important because we're going to see that. So gravity is a constrained system that is going to be, we'll have some gauge symmetries. And of course, you already know that the symmetry we're going to be interested in are the diffeomorphism symmetry. And if we even go to the triad or tetrad formation, we're going to get an additional gauge symmetry, which is going to be this invariance under rotation, so SU2. In 3D here, it's going to be just a SU2 gauge symmetry, okay? Yeah.
So considering diffeos, we usually, or yesterday we consider them as gauge transformations with these local parameters, but you could also have a diffeo that just moves all the space-time just by a translation globally. Mm-hmm. So in that case, would you still consider it as a gauge transformation or as a global one?
No, it's, but I'm, in here you're just considering a very specific case. So gauge transform, so diffeo in general are going to be all the possible things, and it's going to be gauge transformation.
Even if it doesn't have a local parameter.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to come back on this diffeo. And again, as Bianca mentioned it yesterday, in the 3D case, why also 3D is so simple is that the diffeomorphism invariance is going to be just, hidden under behind a much simpler transformation, which is just going to be a symmetry by translation. But this is really specific to the 3D case. So that's why, again, so 3D, as you can see already, is going to be simple because there is no local degrees of freedom. It's a topological theory. And then in addition to that, diffeomorphism invariants are going to be take a much simpler form. Okay? So at least on shell, you can really see diffeo as just a combination of translation and SU2 gauge transformation. But we're going to come back on that. Okay. And yeah, so the article you have to read for this first week is about gauge transformation in general and which kind of interpretation. So here I'm always going to say that, oh yeah, you get some redundancy. So physically, what does it mean in that this one are equivalent? But in Carlos Ravelli article, there is another really nice interpretation. And yeah, I will come back on that a bit later. Okay, so now let's move to, as I said, now we want to understand kind of this relation between conserved quantity and symmetries, but in the Hamiltonian framework. So quickly, let's review quickly the Hamiltonian framework. So since the tutorial yesterday went on that, and I guess everyone is kind of familiar, I just wrote some equation here. So the idea is, so usually your action is written in terms of a Lagrangian, okay? Then the next question is to go to the Hamiltonian formalism is to define the associated momenta. And And from that, we can define what we call the Hamiltonian function, OK? And here, so I just want to make sure that in terms of vocabulary, we all agree. So usually, the set of qi here are going to be what we call the configuration variable. So of course, here, it's quite obvious because the q are the position. But we see that in our context, we're going to talk about gravity. And we will have to make, in fact, a choice. It's not so natural what we call configuration and momentum variable. In fact, it's even, it's a kind of, even in fact, in quantum mechanics, you could choose, it's a choice of polarization, what you call, well, in this very simple system, we are all used to work with q as a position and p as a momentum. So there is no really question here, but in our case, it's kind of a choice of polarization we're going to do. Which variable are we going to consider our configuration variable, and which one are the associated momentum. And so, yeah, here we call that this qi here is a set of configuration. So it's going to define the configuration space. And the space of all pair qi pi is what we call the phase space, OK? So then, of course, we can rewrite this section in the Hamiltonian formalism in terms of q and p and h, OK? And from that, once it's in this, so what we get in the Hamiltonian formulation, because then usually it's the way you kind of get what is a symplectic structure. So here, pi that can be seen here as a function of qi, qi dot, OK. Okay, and so then we associate to that a symplectic structure in terms of the conjugated variable. And that, of course, can be generalized for more general. So then we're going to talk about function defined on this phase space. And the time, so this is a function defined on the phase space. And the time evolution of any function of the phase space is just given via the flow of the Hamiltonian. Okay? So here, it's what we call the flow of the Hamiltonian. And because what we say is that this kind of equation have as solution a flow, or if you want, a curve in the phase space given in terms of, so you can write it, maybe it's easier to see it for q dot and p dot. And the solution of this equation is going to be a curve q of t and p of t in your phase space, OK? And this is what we call the flow here, given some initial condition. And of course, you can use this to kind of write a Taylor expansion of any given function of your phase space. And then we see that this function is generated, is the flow of your function generated by H here. Okay? But any phase space function can generate a flow. It doesn't have to be H. And we're going to see that we're going to use our constraint to see what are the flow generated by the different constraints on our phase space. Okay, so this is what you should all know. So now what become a bit more complicated in our case is that we are dealing with a constraint system. And usually where what you have seen in tutorial yesterday is that where we get a first constraint. So contrary to what you use in Lagrangian, here, when you get the first, what we call the primary constraint, is when you look at this equation, OK? And if this equation is not invertible, OK, then this image of this map has to be described in terms of a constraint. OK, so now we go to the case of constraint Hamiltonian. So for constraint so So if this equation now is not invertible, okay. Then, so if is not invertible, then the image of this map can be described in terms of a set of equation, usually. And this is what we call the primary constraint. And then what we do is, so we started with our phase space, okay, which is described by this whole set of points, of couple of points. And you see that now we're going to add some constraint. So this means that kind of inside our phase space, if you want, you're going to get primary constraint surface, okay, where here the constraints are satisfied. Okay, so this is going to define a primary. Surface. And the way we deal with that is that now we define H, our kind of Hamiltonian H0, that is roughly this one, at least for the P, that just the P are well defined, okay, function. And we add the constraint in terms of Lagrange multiplier. Now, the complete set of equations are going to be the same as before for Q dot and P dot, but you also get that this has to be zero, okay? So maybe something I should emphasize before moving to the example we have seen yesterday in the tutorial is, so what you want is that indeed these constraints are supposed to be conserved quantity. Again, they need to be conserved under time evolution. So you want to check that the time evolution of this constraint is equal to zero, okay? And when it's not the case, so the way you do that is you look at the Poisson bracket of this constraint with your Hamiltonian, and if it's not the case, then you end up with more constraint, okay? But before that, so what is important is that all the physical content of your theory is going to be contained inside the constraint surface, okay? So this means that when you compute now some the flow of any function, for example, with your h, okay, you have that here, if I use this decomposition here, and right now, this question, so right now, these are just function, arbitrary function of your phase space variable, okay? Right now, we don't have any way to constrain them when we are just at the level of the primary constraint. So when you compute any kind of bracket with your new H, you see that this bracket now can be decomposed in terms of two brackets. And you can write that this is because U alpha, again, is going to, right now, is just seen as an arbitrary function on your phase space. Okay, but you see that this is, so now the question is how are we going to compute this, because this right now is just an arbitrary function. But the point is that this term is proportional to this constraint. And this on the constraint surface is equal to zero. So what we use here is, since anything that we are interested, the physics that we are interested is going to be valid on the when we are on the constraint surface, is we're going to use what we call this weakly equality. So this, when we use this symbol, means that it's weakly equal. And by weakly, I mean that it's equal on the constraint surface, okay? And it can be different outside the constraint surface. So on the constraint surface here, what you get is that you can forget about this term, okay? So here, if I replace this equal by, this means that I can forget about this term, okay? And this is a weekly. Equality, and again, weakly equal means that they're equal on the constraint surface. But so now the question we had in the tutorial yesterday was, okay, so it seems that we started with a system with a unique Hamiltonian. So the evolution of our system seems to be well defined, it's zero, but now we had this constraint, and because we had this constraint, we have now this new function that right now are just arbitrary function of your phase space variable. So it seems that you have now not one Hamiltonian to give the evolution of your system, but many Hamiltonians to choose from. So the question we were asking in the tutorial yesterday, and we didn't really answer completely, and I'm going to answer it now, is are we free to choose this parameter as we want, or are there constraints? Okay? And so here we need to first, so maybe to make things clear, so the question here is, about that, are they free or fixed? And you really understand that in the case this parameter are free, you don't have a unique time evolution anymore. Okay? Yeah?
Is this weak equality the same thing as saying that that quantity is zero on shell?
Yeah, so it's going to be, once you have all, so here we don't have all the constraints yet, so we are not at the, because I just look at what are the primary constraints. But in case this Hamiltonian is really H0 plus all the constraints are added, meaning you are on the physical Hamiltonian, you're working on the physical space, then this would be the same thing, that it's essential. Okay, so here just we are at the first kind of stage, but indeed this was. So let's maybe go back quickly to the example we have seen in the tutorial yesterday. And maybe the first example. So this was the Lagrangian given to you, okay? And if you look at look at the Euler-Lagrange equation, you're really going to see that what is going to describe is just a particle moving on a circle, okay? So this means that physically you kind of already understand how many degrees of freedom you're expecting, okay? So it's a particle moving on a circle, so you only expect one physical configuration variable, which can be the angle, okay? And so at the level of the phase space, you expect that the physical, what we call the physical phase space, will be two-dimensional here, okay? But you see that what is the dimension we start with? So dimension of your phase space. So what do you get here? So we have three configuration variables. So the dimension here is just 6. And so we want to go to 2, okay? This is going to be physical. Because we kind of, for this simple system, we kind of know the physical interpretation, so this is easy. Of course, when we go to more complicated system, it's not so always easy to figure out. So here, when you look, if you compute just the conjugated momenta, you see that P3, because there is no V3 here, is going to be 0. So this is what we call your primary constraint. And you have 1. That again, because you expect to go from 6 to 2, you expect at least 4 constraints, okay? So then this is your new Hamiltonian, and then the question was, oh, but is this constraint preserved under time evolution? Meaning, do I have this equation? And this is what you want. And so if it's not automatically 0, you need to impose it, okay, by hand. And at least it has to be weakly 0, so it can be proportional too. So if it's not automatic, then this means that here it's going to define what we call the secondary constraint, okay? And so this is what you did in the tutorial yesterday. You figure out that indeed, if I plug this constraint P3 and I look at this bracket, it's not 0. So I need to impose a secondary constraint. So this was then giving you a secondary constraint. So you see that we're still missing few. So again, you check that this constraint is preserved on time evolution. You look at And you get that this is going to impose, since it's not zero automatically, it's going to give you a third one. Then you reiterate this. This constraint needs to be also preserved under time evolution. And you get a fourth one. Now, of course, from the counting of degrees of freedom, you know that you're expecting four. So you could stop here, but you need to check what this fourth one is going to give you. And here, what is going to give you, so to do really think properly, normally at each stage, you're supposed to, here you see that the Hamiltonian I wrote is kind of what we could call the primary Hamiltonian, meaning I just added the primary constraint here, okay? But you see that here I have only one primary constraint and then I get much more. So normally each constraint should be added to your Hamiltonian for each step. And then what you get is that instead of just a constraint, what you're going to get in this specific case is also some constraint on the Lagrange multiplier. But here, if I forget about that and just keep the primary Hamiltonian, then what I get when I look at the evolution of my fourth constraint here is a constraint on U that is going to impose that this Lagrange multiplier is fixed to zero, okay? So here, I don't have many infinite number of possible Hamiltonian. I really have also still on the physical phase space, I only have one unique Hamiltonian, okay? So time evolution here in this case is unique. But we're going to see how we can characterize the, we were going to see that we can characterize the constraint to really know if, without doing all this calculation, if the Lagrange multiplier are going to be fixed or not, okay? But maybe let's just take the time now to look at this other example that was simpler in terms of calculation, but maybe not simpler in terms of interpretation, okay? Because so here, this is now a new system you consider. And from just looking at it, you could say, oh, I could easily, well, maybe, before doing that. So let's just compute the conjugated momenta. And from computing P1 and P2, what we're going to get is that P1 is equal to P2. So we get here a primary constraint. And here, this is the primary constraint. And now if I look at the time evolution of this constraint, I get that this is zero, okay? So I'm done with the constraint analysis, okay? I have all the constraints of my system. So now the question is, how do we interpret this constraint, okay? So here you could, looking at this Lagrangian, you could see that you could do a change of variable. So which change of variable do you see here that would be relevant?
Q1 plus Q2.
Yeah, okay, so here I define my new one. And then maybe the difference. Okay, so I see that in fact this Lagrangian is only going to act on this big Q variable, okay? And it's not going to say anything about this variable. So we can see that indeed here we kind of have some what we can call as a physical degrees of freedom, or what we could call as just an internal degrees of freedom, okay? And if you really look at, so the flow generated by this constraint on the different variable, we can try to figure out which kind of symmetry we get, okay? Because here the question is that related to a symmetry or not? Is this constraint related to a symmetry or not? And here because, so maybe just to clarify, since we don't have any more equation, you see that the Lagrange, so H is defined as the H, what I call H0, plus U times this constraint. And you see that here the U is not, is can be anything, okay? So here H is, I didn't write it explicitly, but so if now you look at the, so do, can we say that we can any kind of symmetry here? So if you look at the flow generated by So on the phase space variable, meaning you look at delta Q1 given by okay, so if you just compute this Poisson bracket, you get that this is given by this Lagrange multiplier. And you could see that if you do the second one, what you get is now minus u. You can also look at what is the flow what is the transformation by the constraint on the p1 and p2 variable, but it's zero. So here you can see from here that indeed q1 is going to be is invariant under this transformation, okay? Because delta q1 plus q2 is going to be zero under the flow of this constraint. But now q2 is going to be dependent on this u. So you see that here, the constraint is going to change what we could call as an internal degrees of freedom. Okay, so here q1 is really what we is our physical degrees of freedom. Is a physical quantity, and q2 is more an internal one, and And so now, starting from a given initial condition, the state can evolve differently because we are free to choose this u, okay? So here, really, the way we need to interpret this constraint is that it's generating a gauge transformation, okay? And that physically, the state that are evolving under with two different u are supposed to be physically equivalent, okay? And so to go from, so if now we start from a same initial condition, but we can evolve with two different h, with different parameter u, to go from one solution to the other, it's going to be what we call a gauge transformation, okay? So this is what we can, gauge transformation. Okay, so now from these two examples right now, what do we have? We have kind of different kind of variable, of constraint. But is it really the kind of what is relevant to figure out if the symmetry, what is, if we get gauge symmetry or not? So here, what are the kind of constraint we get? We get that we get primary constraint and then all the kind of secondary, tertiary, et cetera, okay? But how, why is it so different between this example, where here all the Lagrange multipliers are going, in fact, to be fixed at the end, and so we don't get any gauge symmetry, but here it seems that indeed we have this freedom of this Lagrange multiplier, and this is what we're going to see that is generating gauge transformation, okay? So how can we, what is the distinction between these two kinds of constraints? So this is, any question here? Or? So here, now it's a section on the different kind of constraint that is quite fundamental. So right now, we have just seen that we have what we call primary, secondary, etc., depending on how long you need to go to get all your constraint. But we're going to see that we need another distinction between, which is between first class and second class. And so this is a very important distinction. So how do we class. Second class. So to make this distinction, first you need to have completed this kind of procedure, meaning you need to have all your constraints in your system. Okay? So now let's just consider a system with constraints where here I'm considering all constraints, okay, meaning primary, secondary, everything has been considered. So this means that you first, to make this distinction, what is really important is to first do this kind of analysis on your system, okay, meaning that you make sure that you have all your constraints. So now, if there is a the first category are going to be what we call the first class, and if, in fact, in practice, it's usually easier to first find the second class, but well, since it's called first class, let's write the definition first. So if there is a subset of constraint, with brackets with all constraint weakly vanishes, so with then all vanish. Here we have something like this. In terms of an equation, this just means that then this set of subset of constraints are what we call the first class constraints. And it can be shown in this case that when you have first class constraint, then there is no restriction on the associated, on the corresponding Lagrange multiplier. Okay? So here in this case, no restriction on associated Lagrange multiplier. And another important point for us is that gauge, and this is of course related to that because we have seen that this means that then we don't have a unique Hamiltonian. So gauge symmetries are generated by first class constraint. Any questions here? Okay, so now what is the definition of the second class? And in fact, usually, yeah, it's easier to figure out what are the second class first. So now if we denote the remaining constraint by remaining then we have the submatrix defined as which is invertible. And in this case, because this is invertible, so you can see already even in this, I think I was writing here, this means that if now your F is one of your constraints, okay, you see that this is going to be, if you're dealing with the second class constraint, then this part is invertible, so you can find an expression of the U, okay? And indeed, in this case, the corresponding Lagrange multiplier are weakly fixed, okay? So first, these constraints are called second class constraints. And in this case, the corresponding weakly, usually it's weakly fixed. Okay, so these are the distinctions which are important, and we're going to see that in the case of 3D gravity, when we, using the Palatini action, we only have first class constraint. Okay, so we are only going to have a gauge transformation. So this is nice because, in fact, usually second class constraint, so there are different ways to deal with them. Usually you try to get rid of them. So you solve them, or maybe you heard about it, you can define, it's kind of equivalent, you can define new bracket, which are the Dirac bracket, okay, where you take into account this second class constraint. And then in this case, then the first. So there are different ways to deal with that. But for example, so in quantum gravity, at some point we're going to mention the spin foam approach at the end of the course, so which is a kind of path integral approach. And in this case, the idea in 4D is to write gravity as a topological theory plus constraint. Because the idea is that we know how to write a spin foam model for any kind of topological theory. So we were like, okay, let's write. And the idea of spin foam then is to try to impose the constraint at the quantum, directly at the quantum level. But the issue with spin foam is then when you write gravity as a topological theory plus some constraint that are supposed to reintroduce the geometrical degrees of freedom, these constraints are not all first class, but some of them are second class. And so to impose them at the quantum level, this is not really, that's some procedure. But to impose them at the quantum level in the spin foam framework is kind of still under question a bit. Okay, so this is still an open problem. But in our case, we're just going to deal with first class constraint, and we're going to see explicitly which kind of symmetry they're going to generate. Okay, so so maybe just so the initial kind of question was to relate conserved quantity, or if you want, constraint with symmetries, okay? And so here I'm telling you, okay, these are gauge symmetries, but how can we see that indeed it's something that leaves the Hamiltonian invariant? It's really because, so you remember, so if, let's call O or C maybe C is better, one of my constraints, and so because it's a constraint, and in particular here, it's what we want is that weakly at least the flow of C generated by H has to be zero, okay? Because it's a conserved quantity, it's what we were saying. But you can kind of reverse the way you're reading this this equation. You can see that this is the flow generated. You can see that H is preserved or is unchanged, unaffected by the flow generated by the constraint. Okay, and this is indeed what we would. So you see that this equation can be kind of read both ways. It's either the flow generated by H, and it tells you that indeed a constraint has to be conserved. But you can also read that as the flow generated by the constraint on your Hamiltonian. And this means that indeed the Hamiltonian of your system is unchanged by the thing. So it's what we call usually symmetry. Okay, and so now maybe just a few things about how do we relate now. So as you see, we're going to start, contrary to maybe what you used, we're going to start from a phase space that is usually much bigger than the physical phase space. So, and we are not going to deal only, so here you see that this was simple. We had a phase space with 6-dimensional, and we knew that the physical phase space was 2-dimensional. And so when I asked the question in the tutorial, how many constraints are you expected, you all answer 4. And indeed, here we get 4. But all these constraints, so this you can try to check, are what we call second class constraints. And indeed, they do not generate any gauge transformation. But the point is that if now you're dealing with gauge transformation, the way you count the number of degrees of freedom is a bit different. Okay? Because why is that different? So maybe let's just take the time to make this distinction here, which is important for the rest. So let's and is there any question before maybe that I go to this part? No, okay.
Actually, I have a question.
Oh.
So in classical systems that are in equilibrium, we expect that the system will always be on the constrained surface, right?
Yeah.
So we only really care about the distinction between weak equality and not weak equality if we go to quantum level or out of equilibrium system.
But is also I think the system you have in mind don't have also the distinction between gauge transformation. Okay, because here in the case of gauge transformation, just being on the constraint system, on the constraint surface, is okay, but it's still not the physical degrees of freedom. You need to kind of gauge again by your gauge orbit. Okay, you need to. So this is what I'm going to explain. But also, are we? Yeah. To answer your question. Even classically, but at least, yeah, in gravity, even classically, working at the really at the what we call physical, at the level of physical phase space is not really simple. And we're going to see that because at some point, and I think it's related because we are dealing with a gauge symmetry, because something that are going to be important for us to work with are going what we call Dirac observables that are going to be functions that are going to be weakly zero with the Poisson bracket with all these functions with are going to be weakly zero with all the constraint, which. And indeed, these objects are important for quantization because when you're dealing with quantization of constraint system, the idea of these Dirac observables is that they are not going to carry any of the gauge information, and so also no fluctuation in the unphysical gauge direction. Okay, because this is so. Yeah, maybe it's more when you go to the that is important. This is really important indeed when you quantize because. When you want to quantize something, if you quantize a non-gauge invariant object, then you're really expecting, in addition, some fluctuation or in the physical gauge direction. Okay, but again, this is also something that is being reconsidered now. And the article of Carlo about to consider gauge symmetry and gauge degrees of freedom are in fact maybe important when you want to consider coupled system. And even, so right now in the quantum gravity community, many people are working on this kind of soft mode things where they consider like, and this is related to this question of gauge degrees of freedom or not. So yeah, all these questions, but you're right that it's usually mainly important where we go to the quantum level. Okay, but maybe this is also going to clarify if I kind of do this drawing here. So the idea is that what we do now is that we start with, like, let's say that this is what we call kinematical phase space, okay? So now we are going to really distinguish between the different phase space. So the one without any constraint is what we're going to call the kinematical phase space. And as we see, it can be big. And so here, then we want to go to the notion of physical, or sometimes it's also called radio phase space. So, like, let's say that this is our kinematical phase space. The constraint now are going to define a kind of hypersurface on which they are satisfied. And this can be, then is going to be the so-called constraint surface. Okay, so this is my constraint surface. And so when we're specifically dealing with constraints that are first class, so generate the gauge transformation, then we're going to see that the fact that they are first class is going to guarantee that the gauge transformation generated by the constraint preserves the constraint surface. Okay? Because now if you look at the Poisson bracket between any first class constraint, their bracket is going to be weakly zero, or if you want, which means that they are proportional to another constraint. Okay, so this means that, so if now you look at the flow generated by a constraint on another constraint, it remains on the constraint surface. So what gauge transformation are going to define, they are going to kind of define trajectory on this constraint surface, what we call the gauge orbit. Okay, and so to really select the physical degrees of freedom, then you need to kind of say that, so this is a gauge orbit, and it's really just the flow generated by one of the constraints. And so points now along this gauge orbit correspond to the same physical configuration. Okay, so to describe, that are kind of described only in different, for example, coordinate system. And so to really select the physical degrees of freedom here, you need to divide by the gauge orbit. Okay, so to say that all these points are physically equivalent. So you see that contrary to here, where we started with a gauge, with a phase space of dimension 6, and we were expecting 4 constraints to get to a physical phase space of dimension 2, if we are dealing only with first class constraints, so gauge symmetry, we only expect 2 constraints, okay, because how you compute the number of degrees of freedom, you first need to say the constraints are going to. So, yeah. So when you are a first class constraint, so you start with the number of degrees of freedom or the dimension of your dimension of your kinematical phase space. And to get to the physical one, to get the dimension of the physical one, it's minus the number of first class time 2 here, okay? Because again, you also need to divide by the gauge orbit. So you divide by the, you solve the constraint, so you go on the constraint surface, but then again, you need to divide by the gauge orbit. So this, you get this kind of counting of degrees of freedom to get the dimension of the, if you only have first class of all. And so we're going to, in the case of gravity, we are only going to deal with first class constraint, which in the case of 3D gravity can be seen as so SU2 gauge transformation and some translational gauge transformation. And so we will see that in detail. So tomorrow, I'm going to conclude here. Tomorrow, we're going to turn our attention on a particular type of constraint system, which is a totally constrained system. So which is very similar to what we're going to get in gravity. So gravity is a totally constrained system. But before going to this very, where the math are going to be much more complicated, we're going to do the kind of canonical analysis of the just parametrized particle that is a totally constrained system. And then on this example, I'm going to show you what does it mean to quantize it using the Dirac program. Like this, you have a kind of idea what is a Dirac program in case of a constrained system, and then we will move to gravity. Okay? Okay, thanks.